Here was Stuart Brandberg, conducted in Darby, Montana on March 20th, year 2003, by Roger Kay. Stuart, well, thank you so much for doing this with me today. I'd like to ask you to begin with a brief biographical sketch of your background, where you're from, and how you got into this wilderness work.
I was raised in a family, mother and dad, who had a great appreciation for wildlife and wild country, and that took me and my sister on major expeditions into the wilderness of Idaho and western Montana. This partially, substantially, I would say, because of my dad's service for 40-odd years within the United States Forest Service here in the Bitterroot. He was supervisor for 20 years. I was influenced by a fine biologist at the Rocky Mountain Laboratory, William Jellison, who took young people, a group of young men, into the woods and under the ranges of our wonderful game animals. Decided to take up wildlife biology, attended the University of Montana for my undergraduate, and became involved with field studies, range, timber surveys, opportunity to live on wilderness lookouts for a couple of years, all that I grew to value more and more through the years. But in that process, was invited to be a part of a mountain goat life history study. Picked up on that in 1947 for the next 7 years. Devoted a major part of my time to research while attending the University of Idaho Wildlife Research Unit. It was with the Fish and Game Departments of Idaho and Montana that I worked on mountain goat studies, and I had become the area big game biologist for the northern part of Idaho, and I was offered a job with the National Wildlife Federation in 1954 by Charles Callison, then conservation director. That took me into 4.5 years of legislative work with Callison, working in all areas of conservation, particular concern with wildlife, and of course very strong support for the wilderness bill offered by the Wildlife Federation and led by Callison. This put me in contact with Howard Zonizer, I would say in about 1955. I became a member of the Governing Council in 1956.
Of the Wilderness Society.
Of the Wilderness Society. And then, as a part of the executive committee, worked closely with Zonizer. I was given great latitude and freedom to pursue the wilderness bill in support of the Zonizer campaign. Indeed, the Wildlife Federation was one of his stalwart organizations that did much to promulgate understanding of the bill. That took me through some 4 years with the Federation in 1960, when the Federation became embroiled in a controversy. Callison and others within my friendship circle departed. I went to the Society and asked for a job, and Zonizer encouraged me to be in touch with the then President Harvey Broome. It was decided that if I could make my magnificent salary of $8,000 through use of direct mail and other skills I'd captured at the Federation, I could go to work. So I was enlisted for a position as a project director of special projects, I think the title was. From that, after a couple of years, I became associate director under Zonizer. And when he succumbed in 1964, May, I was appointed to succeed him Mm-hmm. Well, the rest is history.
So you were director of the Wilderness Society then?
I became his replacement in May of 64 on the eve of this final signing of the bill in September.
Uh-huh.
So it was my task at that point. We had waged this long campaign, 56 to 64, 8 years,
mm-hmm.
17 congressional hearings, a strenuous effort to organize grassroots people for the wilderness cause and in support of the bill. It was my task to make people aware that in this great accomplishment in setting a national policy and a preservation program, we had only included some 8 million acres of wilderness in the wilderness system,
mm-hmm.
and that all the rest had to come through the laborious process of public hearings, local studies, passage of the proposals up through the hierarchy of the agencies to the Congress, again a round of hearings to see the inclusion of these areas in the wilderness system. So that took me into implementation, and what I feel was my contribution in organizing grassroots teams
mm-hmm.
in some 40 states in support of wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
Is that enough on
that's
that
great.
Overview?
That's a great background. So let's move to the Arctic Refuge then. When you were with the National Wildlife Federation as conservation director, you were their representative on the refuge issue. And what were some of the things that you did with the Wildlife Federation in support of the campaign to establish the Arctic Refuge?
Of course, had fallen under the influence of Howard Zonizer, Callison at the Federation, and the Muries. Olis had come to the University of Montana in the 40s at the mm-hmm. Northwest Section meeting of the Wildlife Society.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And here was this sweet, humble epitome of the fine biologist.
Can you stop it?
Yeah. The infusions from Olis and Zani, I think, crystallized my thinking about the rich experience I'd had in the backcountry. Those months on the lookout and working on trail and telephone line and the wild country,
mm-hmm.
In the great trips I'd had with my family. So it gave a framework for something that was deep in my psyche, my life, but here it was brought together as a cause that needed our best effort to realize protection of all of the unique things we experienced in the wild setting.
Mm-hmm.
I was working under Callison on legislation, on educational campaigns. I'm sure that part of my job was to make contact with those members of the Congress, their staffs,
mm-hmm.
to give them background on the Arctic Range,
mm-hmm.
to support this effort. And of course, in effective lobbying, the best job you can do is to say, here is Olis Murray,
mm-hmm.
here is Marty Murray.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the realization of the value of those people. So wherever we could convene good, open-minded staff people and members of the Congress, House or Senate,
mm-hmm.
We would do that. And mm-hmm. that was my expertise, not that I
mm-hmm.
had fully accomplished all that I ultimately realized as a base of my competence as a lobbyist,
mm-hmm.
but I know that these people had touched me, and that as a representative of the Federation, I could speak with real conviction and eloquence because of my tie to these spirited people.
Interesting. Were the people, the legislators and so on that you lobbied, touched or influenced by the Muries and their philosophy about wilderness?
Some were. The John Saylors, the Lee Metcalfs,
mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. Representative Saylor, Senator Metcalf, just to name a couple. In that period, conservation and an environment were not popular causes.
Mm-hmm.
You introduced yourself with your card. The best way to get into a congressional office was to have people call from the home, state, or district saying, we're sending in Stuart Brimbaugh to discuss this issue with you.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of background in doing that. Mm-hmm. So if I really wanted to get in, I would call the local affiliate of the Wildlife Federation, Sportsman's Group, and say, would you mind calling that office and telling them we have this important issue to bring to them?
Nice.
That would prepare the groundwork. Uh-huh. But at that time, you walked in, you didn't necessarily get a warm reception if you didn't have that kind of introduction.
I see.
But there were those, let's say, epitomized by John Saylor, who embraced the concept.
Mm-hmm.
He knew it and he felt it. And so he would steep in the presence of Ois and Marty and Sonny.
Uh-huh.
He savored them for what they stood for as people.
Uh-huh.
And their testimonials. Mm-hmm. He loved what they spoke for. He sensed the values that they represented.
Oh, great.
Some others, later, the Udalls, they were good. Senator Nelson was good. Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota, the first introducer of the bill on the Senate side, the wilderness bill. These people had the feeling. They had the measure of the quality of these spirited folks who spoke for the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
And they themselves sensed what we valued.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. What did you do as far as your position with the Wildlife Federation to encourage members to write their representatives and get involved? Did you have a campaign to involve members?
A very strenuous campaign, particularly as we went into the hearings for the wilderness bill. It was outreach, mobilizing the people in Idaho. In fact, I was assigned to go with Ted Trueblood with my 35-millimeter slides on the life history of the mountain goat. We held meetings at the Rotary in the schools all the way from southern Idaho up to Sandpoint and the Canadian line, every community that we could reach, just proselytizing for the bill, explaining why it was so very important to gain its passage. But in every instance, when there was a field hearing, we as a wilderness society staff would go into the grassroots communities, bring together those who shared this concern about wilderness. And that concern had been nurtured through a series of mailings that Zonizer engineered from the Congress to citizens using the mailing lists of the Wildlife Federation and most of the conservation groups, and numbering into the hundreds of thousands. As I recall, the Federation was some 300,000. There was Audubon, there was the Sierra Club, there was the National Parks Association, and other groups. Those lists, the Wilderness Society, everybody had received these descriptions of the bill, its purposes, the rationale for its passage, the speeches that were made by Saylor and Humphrey upon introduction. So people had repeated mailings saying, here is the wilderness bill, here is the effort that we're making, here is why people from all over the country must be in touch with their members of Congress to voice their support. Mm-hmm. So it was that foundation that gave us the starting point.
Mm-hmm. So then, was this the same approach you took, but probably a much smaller scale in your advocacy for the Arctic Wildlife Refuge?
I think with the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, of course, you focus on the key committees, House and Senate, and you focus on those members that will be friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So you do that systematic approach you call and mail to your membership out in that state and the key leaders. And you say, here's the Arctic, here's what it means, here are the magnificent dimensions of what it represents for wildlife and wilderness. Mm-hmm. And you have those people apply words of encouragement and pressure to those who are on that committee. And then, of course, you're watching that vote. You're going in from the Washington level to say, how's the congressman doing? What will the senator do on this? You're talking to staff. You're talking to the member. You're walking with a member to the House floor or the Senate floor. You're catching him wherever you can, but you're nailing down his vote. And I'm damnably sure that was my job on the Arctic, along with Callison, along with Zonizer. The Murrays, of course, were not in the Washington scene except when they came to visit. So it was, and I think C.R. Gudermuth, the Wildlife Management Institute, Ira Gabrielson, I think they were fully in ownership of this campaign. You probably read in the context of this documentation their testimony. But they were working with Zani, with Callison in coalition.
Now the document that you just pointed there, Stuart, is the a hearing record for the Congressional Senate testimony that you gave on behalf of the National Wildlife Federation in 1959, recommending establishing the Arctic Refuge. And reading through there, one thing that interests me is it's very eloquently written, your testimony, but you're representing a group that's largely hunters and hunting interests, and yet you don't focus on that as being the value of setting this place aside.
I believe that's because of my own personal feeling and love for the living creature. An appreciation that emanates, I believe, from my parents, but having come out of wildlife management schools, you know them, the heavy emphasis on harvest, having survived with Anna V on elk and deer meat through the winters, being a hunter, I think I was increasingly appreciative of the living creature. And while I had to represent the interests of the hunting community and recognize appropriateness of hunting in specific places, I didn't feel in my heart that this was the function of the Arctic to provide hunting opportunity any more than we, any of us, emphasized recreation.
So what then did you see as the primary value of what became the Arctic Range?
I believe I saw through the eyes of Oldis and Marty the magnificence of the area, the rich community of wildlife in this spacious, endless panorama, and here was the community of life, and this spectacle, this museum, and these people were so articulate and so persuasive that influence came in on what I'd had as a kid and as a young biologist in the field, and it coalesced with all the things in my background to make me see that in the wild, untrammeled setting, we had things that far transcended the human experience of taking an animal or indulging in one kind of recreation or another. Putting oneself in that setting as an observer who traveled as quietly and unobtrusively as he could, but to savor it, to measure it, to watch it, and above all, to leave it untouched as mm-hmm. much as humanly possible.
In your testimony to the Senate in 59, you, I'll quote, you talked about the importance of an area free from man's domineering influence. Tell me what you meant by that in the context of the Arctic Refuge.
Significant signs, of course, of human presence. Mm-hmm. And really, I get down to any signs of human presence. What I was thinking about then, I can't bring back. But basically, leaving the setting without any signs of having been there as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's incumbent upon us. And I think that's the test that we face now. How do we give support to wilderness with a public that says, this is the ultimate criterion.
Mm-hmm.
We will come, we will savor, we will indulge ourselves, but we will leave it basically untouched. Well, of course, it's almost impossible to not leave some sign.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that is what I felt at the time, as much as I can project into that period 50 years ago almost.
Mm-hmm. Well, your quote, free of man's domineering influence, is very similar to the Wilderness Act statement of wilderness is in contrast where man and his works dominate. So it seems like your advocacy for the Arctic Refuge and the Wilderness Act was very, very much the same. Is that?
I think undoubtedly, because mm-hmm. I had been one of the early readers of the Wilderness Bill drafts. Mm-hmm. Zionizers was leaning on me to look for imperfections as he was looking for people like you. In the agencies, there were Dick Griffith, people in the Forest Service, many different disciplines to whom he presented the draft of the Wilderness Bill and asked that they read it and study it, refine the language, and make it as good as they could for the purpose of the wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
So by this time, almost on the eve of the introduction of the Wilderness Bill, right in this period,
mm-hmm.
I had been exposed to those words and those thoughts,
mm-hmm.
most of which had flown from Zionizer's good mental process to the tablet where he did his first draft of the bill.
Uh-huh.
And so that stuff was being fed into my system.
Mm-hmm. So I notice you use the word wildness as an adjective, as a descriptive of the values of this place and some of your writings and so on. Tell me what you meant by wildness and what some of the parts of it are.
Well, of course, coming on the scene as a visitor, watching the land, with envision of the magnificent glaciated mountain basin, the meadow, the lichens, the mosses, the Labrador tea, that's where
mm-hmm.
some of the country we both know. I think there's, in periods of isolation when you're by yourself, you do feel that there is an energy, a presence that is much greater than self, that you're just there.
Hmm.
And that you watch this and you feel this and you listen and you hear, you marvel at what's there and you absorb what's there to the best of your ability. In the absence of the knowledge of all that goes on within the lichen or the lemming, but the hoary marmot, mm-hmm. the caribou, it's enveloping, it comes over you, and you sit and absorb at the marvel of it. Now, what else?
So is this the wildness of the wilderness that you refer to?
This is the wildness.
Mm-hmm.
No patterns of conformity, no impacts of human beings, the communities of animal and plants,
mm-hmm.
The glacial geological forces, they're all there. Working in their timeless way. Any reflection brings you to the realization that this is the evolutionary process of life, and the landforms. You are here as an observer, and you're here as a humbled agent who gets to see this without any interference on what's taking place.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you mentioned the word evolution, because Olaus Murray used that very often in his wilderness writings. The idea being, let me ask if I understand Murray correctly from your understanding of him, that a part of the value of this place would be evolutionary process would be free to continue here, unhindered by people, and that was that a value of this place to you?
I think very definitely. Here's the spot where things are continuing,
mm-hmm.
and the landform is changing, the animals are changing, the plants are changing, the climate may change.
Mm-hmm.
It's the epitome of evolutionary process if we can keep our hands off of it.
Mm-hmm. Great. Does that contribute to the scientific value of the place, and was that a concern of yours or a value of this place?
Yes, I always identified the scientific value, but I recognize that scientific exploration would pose a threat to wilderness.
Mm-hmm.
If we got carried away with it,
mm-hmm.
the intrusion of science in a way that interfered with, inhibited natural evolutionary process,
mm-hmm.
would itself be destructive of mm-hmm. the wilderness and the wildness.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that came to us as it is here today.
Mm-hmm.
We can't tolerate intrusions on the wilderness that are destructive,
mm-hmm.
in the name of science.
Mm-hmm. Olaus used the word spiritual value and intangible values quite a bit. Did this place hold some intangible value for you like this? I think some of these values you're expressing are intangible, but...
I believe so. Interestingly, in references to spiritual values, from Sinizer Murray and the two that I knew the best, Harvey Broom, Sig Olson,
mm-hmm.
Oberholzer, and I'm not mentioning others that were rich in their philosophical base,
mm-hmm.
their spiritual base. I don't read or remember their references to the deity, to God.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in those people and myself, there's a rich spiritual feeling that comes, and some of the best expressions of that were from Olaus in describing what had happened to him when he walked around the block waiting for a bus. I think it was up in Pennsylvania on his way to Washington, when he met me for dinner with Marty.
Mm-hmm.
He said he came to a place where the the beautiful leaves of fall had come together, and he looked into that, montage, and he saw that there were transcendent things beyond us. And I remember conversations with Marty where we said, you know, some of these things that flow together in our lives are by some design. Mm. There is synchronicity. Things come together and are meant to be. And I think many times in my life, in the Salmon River Canyon and in the high basins of the Bob Marshall or the Selkirk Mountains of northern Idaho, and I had my wilderness experience in these areas on the mountain goat research that I was doing, the Bob Marshall, the Salmon River Canyon, the Selkirk Mountains. Yes, I think you feel a spiritual influence. And I don't think I tied that to any specific higher power, but felt that there was a strong spiritual influence. I don't know that I ever really discussed that with Howard Sonnheiser, although we both had spiritual experiences in the cathedrals of Washington.
Uh-huh.
It was our habit to, when I drove with him to and from work, to stop by the cathedral or the Catholic shrine and stand in awe within these structures, just finding, I guess, ourselves in the midst of the flurry to do all these things for the Wilderness Bill and the membership of the Wilderness Society and holding the operation together, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly a heavy feeling of spirituality within these characters, rich characters. Harvey Broome, Howard Sonnheiser, Sig Olson, and of course, Olis and Marty.
Mm-hmm. How about Bob Marshall? Now, you were probably pretty young in his time, but
yeah.
I know you met him as a child, and your father knew him, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, when Bob Marshall retired from the Forest Service, his brother Bob, his brother George, had run on old notes, and those old notes indicated there were five people in the Forest Service that Bob recommended for his replacement in the Office of Recreation of the Chief.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was my father.
Oh, really?
And I don't know whether my dad had been with him on more than the one occasion when I remember Bob coming to our home.
Mm-hmm.
He had hiked from the Selway River over the Montana Divide down into Boulder Creek and on the West Fork of the Bitterroot in one day.
Really?
A tremendous, a tremendous exertion, 40-odd, 50 miles.
Mm-hmm.
His face was sunburned, and he was at our dining room table, and my mother served dinner.
Mm-hmm.
I remember him, I suppose that would have been in the 30s before his death. And between, I think he passed on in 39, so it would have been 35 to 39 in that period.
Now, is that the table that in front of us here in your house?
That's right. That's the dining room table.
This one here?
This one here.
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. Which chair did Bob sit in?
We didn't label it, but I suggest to those who love wilderness that you rotate through the chairs so you can be sure we have the right spot. And there are only two sides, and I think he was sitting across from me with my mother and father on both ends. So we can bring that back.
Well, Stuart, you mentioned you and Zonizer in D.C. stopping by monuments to, more like you said, find yourself in the larger scheme of things. Do you think that for Zonizer, yourself, and others, this Arctic Refuge proposal was perhaps a symbolic place or served some function like a monument?
Yes, I think there was a very definite feeling that the preservation of this unique landscape represented in a special way a sanctuary for nature. Mm-hmm. And nature was epitomized in its preservation. That the word sanctuary almost came down to wilderness. If you preserved wilderness, you had given us another area that was indeed a sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
And that encompassed Olus's repeated emphasis on evolutionary process, that here were living things in this setting. Here was the natural process continuing, but you had to have a place where this was recognized, set apart, its value for its wild characteristics, identified and embraced, and the process of giving its status, the wilderness law, accomplished that. Placement in the wilderness system, the purity of the wilderness system, is up to us. But if we encompass the concept of sanctuary, we, in our protection and our respect for that sanctuary, will see that the area is protected from our intrusions, from all that we bring to it as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
Sanctuary is a special theme, and I think it's within the wilderness setting, when we're by ourselves and we look at all that's around us, that we get the sense of sanctuary that you allude to in the lovely cathedral in this setting of Washington, D.C. or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
A person by himself recognizing the immensity of this evolutionary creation and being humbled by it, coming down to appreciation of what we as human beings are, perhaps more importantly, what this special place represents. If we leave it as it is.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned humility. Is that part of the experience or part of the aura of the place?
I don't think there's any question that you're in this setting and you feel you are humbled.
Mm-hmm.
That you're all of these things that have made this scene what it is, and you're just there to savor and absorb. But you as a human will do best by it if you leave it without any disturbance or interference.
Mm-hmm. Earlier you mentioned Sigurd Olsen a couple of times, and of course Olsen was one of the people who was also involved in establishing the Arctic Refuge. What do you remember of Sig and his orientation towards wilderness?
Well, I remember Sig as one of my great beloved supporters within the Wilderness Council, the Circle. And I remember Sig most outstandingly as a supporter of the Wilderness Bill when people within the Council would challenge Zani and me, but mostly Zani, for sticking through this long, strenuous fight when the going was tough. And people would say, let's just promote the concept of wilderness. We don't need this wilderness bill as the bulwark around which we preserve lands. So Sig, as my intimate friend, would be briefed by me on what we needed to overcome the sharp criticisms of Zionizers in the setting of the council meeting, and Sig would come in with his eloquence, his deep voice, and say, by God, we have to go all the way to gain enactment of this legislation. Without this, we don't have the framework of policy. We don't have a system that will include these unique lands from these different jurisdictions of the government. We have to have this as a foundation for the work that we're doing. Without this, we don't have the base for people to work in giving lands permanent dedication. We will be constantly subjected to the wayward ways of the individual bureaucratic interpretations of what wild country is. We have to set these standards, the policies. We will be beaten by the attrition that occurs from different land managers in different agencies in different sections of the country, doing all kinds of things to manipulate and abuse wild country in a way that's inimical to wilderness. So I remember that most of all about Sig Olsen. I remember his deep eloquence in speaking to points of principle, but I remember him as my faithful backer in the years when he was president, when I, as a relatively young head of the Wilderness Society, was right there to listen to me, to help me make the judgments, but sustain me through thick and thin. And sometimes within the council, as for Zionizer, there were some tough criticisms. They were criticisms built around finance. There were criticisms built about around Zani's judgments. Zani was famous for involving the person with whom he was engaged in development of all the alternatives that were before him. Here are the ways we could proceed. Here's what Senator Humphrey said. Here's what Congressman Saylor said. Here's what the chairman of the committee is doing. What do you think? He enveloped you in discussions of strategy. Yet on occasion, members of our council would go at him in an adversarial way that was extremely disturbing to him and to me, his chief ally and supporter. On occasion, he left meetings in a state of frustration. They wouldn't treat me as a young person the way they would go after him. That's what I want to get in some of my history of the Wilderness Bill, and I shall. But and it's a little digression, but it. When you say, "What do you think about SIG?" I think of those sessions where we were tense, the stakes were high, because people were saying, "You're not doing what we need to have done, Sennheiser," and to a degree, me, but it was focused on Sonny. And Sig would come in with his great ovations, and he would set them right on their butts.
Oh, great. Wow. What's your sense of Sig Olson's main interest in wilderness? What was the chief value? Was it recreation, wildlife? What did you see Sig as? What motivated Sig so strongly?
His feeling for it. His spiritual appreciation. He loved it in its totality. he loved to be there. He savored it in every sense. But I don't think he thought of it so much as recreation. I think he felt it. It reached him when he was there. And he had that capacity, that great ability to articulate that.
When you say it reached him, tell me what you mean
by
that.
It took over. It took, as it does, I think, most of us that are